Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements with black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Fuck coins, hell pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit won't be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Fuck coins, hell pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
War no more. You can't say that. You say, well, we don't need guns. We need books. Shut up, fool. The white man make all the guns. How we gonna go up against the white man? We can't compete with the white man with all the guns. Well, fool, he make all the books. How you gonna compete with him if he makes all the books? You willing to go that route? I was talking to a young Sunni Muslim brother at Mart 125 yesterday. He said, well, do you really think we still oppressed in America? I'm not lying, as God is my witness. Young brother, but he has a good chance, this young brother. He said, you think we still oppressed? And he went on to show me how things had changed and how we weren't oppressed anymore. He really believed that. And I told him, since I knew he was coming from Islam, I told him that Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that Prophet Muhammad said, you must stop the oppressor. stop the hand of the oppressor. Physically stop him. The Holy Quran says, and fight. Fight with those who fight against you. That persecution and bloodshed, that persecution and the murder of your people is worse than bloodshed. Quran says better to go on and fight and shed some blood, but persecution and the shedding of blood and the slaughter of your people, it's not worse than dealing with your enemy and shedding your enemy's blood. Fight. Fight with those who fight against you. It says, and drive them out from where they drove you out. It says, and fight with them until there is no more war. Fight with them until there is no more bloodshed. I told him that Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, stop the hand of the oppressor. Physically, fight him. But Prophet Muhammad goes on to say, if you can't fight him physically and stop his hand physically, speak out against him. Strongly speak out against him. And if you can't stop him physically and stop the hand of the oppressor physically, if you can't speak out boldly and strongly against him, Prophet Muhammad said, then secretly protest in your heart. But secret protest in your heart is the poorest and the weakest form of protest, he said. He said, oh, see, I put his man on him. That's the way we got to be. We got to know all of the doctrines, all of the philosophy, all of the ideology, so we can go after our people and bridge the gap and pull them together and form an African United Front or a Black United Front. But we got to know what they know and then some. So when I put Prophet Muhammad on him and told him that, you know, if you want to secretly protest in your heart, the Nabi or the Prophet said, that's the poorest form of protest. Then he's ready to talk. So the day he saw me, I was over there. He was very excited. He wanted another conversation. So I drop a little something else on him, and he's a good little brother coming along. I'm almost there, if you'll give me just a few more minutes. There would be less police brutality if the masses were armed. Mark Furman's would be hard to find. Mark Furman was not an exception to the rule. Mark Furman talked about the brotherhood of policemen, the fraternity of policemen. He said that the policeman is God. That's what he said. He's the devil saying that the policeman is God. He's judge, jury, and executor. Huh? Right on the spot. He talked about how he used to beat black men and women and Chicano brothers and sisters until he would just beat the waste out of them, beat the mess out of them. He said, then you could smell the niggas and the Mexicans or the Chicano. You could smell them. I mean, you could smell them stinking. He said you couldn't get into the jail for the stench coming from them. They just beat them until they urinate on themselves, beat them until their bowels would waste all over. He said he'd grab them and just throw them down the steps, just throw them down. And another cracker down at the other end of the steps, or catch him at the other end of the step, kick him and beat him. No, you got to stop. I'm here to tell you that the only way you're going to stop police brutality is you got to stand up and be brutal with this damn beast. You got to step to this cracker or it will never stop. You can moan, you can groan, you can sing, you can pray. You can recite, you can claim you know all the Quran, Old Testament, all the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, the Quran from Al-Fatiha to Al-Nas. You can know all the Medunetah. You can know Maya, truth, justice, righteousness, harmony, balance, order, reciprocity. You can name those of the Netter system. You can go and study the Odu text and substantiate your position according to Odu. You can study the Ifa, or the Word, or the Akan, or the Yoruba, and run through the pantheon of the Orisha. You can call on Oludumare. You can call on Ilegba, and Shango, and Obatula, and Oshun, and Ogun, and Yemonya. You can know all of that. But unless you're willing to stand up and step to this white man, we will never get out of this condition. Frederick Douglass said the limits of a tyrant is prescribed by exactly how far you will let that tyrant go. He won't stop if you don't stop him. It's like any bully. The bully will keep picking on you until you get him to raise up off of you. But some of us will lose our lives. Tupac is gone already. Biggie is gone already. Many of us, Yusuf Hawkins is gone already. Many of us are already dead, and we're dying every day. And while we're here in Queens tonight, black men and women and young black boys are dying at the hands of some cracker somewhere in America right now. I would rather die for a cause than to die because you in some barroom pinching somebody's wife on the booty on the bar stool and get your throat cut with a Miller Lite bottle. It's a hell of a life, man. That's a hell of a way to go. Say, your daddy got killed. Say, yeah. How'd he get killed? Say, he pinched somebody's wife on the booty at the bar stool. The dude picked up a Miller Lite bottle of Budweiser Light. Broke it and cut his throat. Is that the way he died? Well, he died in the East Coast, West Coast fight. East Coast, West Coast. You're a damn fool. You'll die over some bullshit? Some damn records? A damn CD? You are what you call a recording studio gangster? Oh, you bad as hell in the recording studio. Ain't a nigga in the world badder than you. Capone couldn't mess with you. Babyface Nelson. None of them couldn't mess with you. A recording studio gangster. You just as bad as you can be. You gon' blow, put your gat in the nigga's mouth and blow the nigga's brains out. I'll stomp that hoe. I'll kick that bitch. White man show up, you can hear a rat pee on cut. Nigga ain't ready to fight. Nigga ain't ready to fight. I say we must arm the masses. Most of y'all got guns anyway. You shoot them for the 4th of July. Damn day that ain't even your Independence Day. Yes, you do. You shoot them on New Year's and New Year ain't in yet. You just got them. They're just toys. Or you'll go get them on your wife. Draw the gun on her because she burnt the beans for the 4th time. She'll just go order some beans. Or she'll draw the pistol on you because the phone rang at 2 in the morning and you stayed on too long, talking too low. Two or three brothers so bad. I'm Crip. Two or three brothers so bad. I'm Blood. They'll go off into territory of their rival brother gang and face bumper jacks, face chains, baseball bats, pipes, nines, AKs, face everything in a fratricidal war with your kith and kin, your flesh and blood, your brother.
Crack cocaine in a sweeping inner city community. No, actually, President Reagan announced his drug war a few years before crack hit the streets. But once it did, the Reagan administration seized on this development with glee, actually hiring staff whose job it was to publicize inner city crack babies, crack dealers, launched a media campaign, you know, to expose, you know, crack in inner city communities in the hopes of building public support for a drug war they had already declared. And the plan worked like a charm. Our television sets were flooded with images of black and brown, you know, drug users and dealers, crack babies, the whole nine. Our television sets were saturated for nearly a decade with these images. And in short order, Democrats began competing with Republicans to show they could even be tougher on crime than them. They could be even tougher. And President Clinton, you know, boasted outside on the campaign trail. He boasted in front of a prison where, you know, a man was being, had just been executed, you know, a mentally impaired African-American man being executed. He flew from the campaign trail to watch the execution and then stood outside the prison saying, you know, I can be nicked a lot, but nobody can say I'm not tough on crime. President Clinton in office, again, attempting to win over those same so-called white swing voters. He, you know, championed three strike laws. You know, he presided over the largest increase in African-American imprisonment in our nation's history. He and the New Democrats championed legislation barring drug felons from public housing, no matter how minor the offense, denying them from basic public benefits, including food stamps for the rest of their life. Discrimination is now perfectly legal in virtually every aspect of political, economic, and social life once you've been branded a felon. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has, you know, for the most part, turned a blind eye to race discrimination in the criminal justice system. Now, people often ask me, you know, if racial bias is as bad as you say it is in the criminal justice system, why don't you file some more lawsuits about it? You know, how come we don't hear about people filing lawsuits in the news, you know, challenging the bias of police or prosecutors? And, you know, what if it's so bad, why don't we see more lawsuits about this? But what people don't realize is that the U.S. Supreme Court has made it virtually impossible to file claims of race discrimination in the criminal justice system. As I describe in some detail in Chapter 3, the court has closed the courthouse doors to claims of racial bias at every stage of the criminal justice process, beginning with, you know, stops and searches, to plea bargaining, and sentencing. In a series of cases, you know, beginning with, you know, Armstrong versus the United States, McCleskey versus Kemp, the Supreme Court has made clear that only evidence of conscious, intentional bias, the very sort of bias that is nearly impossible to prove these days in the absence of an admission, is deemed sufficient. Now, of course, most folks, including most law enforcement folks, know better than to say, I stopped him because he was black. I didn't give him the good plea deal because he's black. Most people, some don't, but most people have enough sense not to acknowledge their bias openly in the so-called era of color blindness. But the U.S. Supreme Court has insisted on that kind of proof in order to even get in the courthouse doors. The court has, a practical matter, closed the courthouse doors. It said no matter how overwhelming your statistical evidence, no matter how severe the racial disparity, unless you can offer proof of conscious, intentional bias, you do not have a case to make of discrimination in the criminal justice system. And in this way,
you know what I'm talking about. Don't you? All right. I thought you did. He discovered America with all these people here. When he takes something, when he steals something, when he roughs something, when he robs something, when he bum rushes somebody's place and just wipes out whatever they got and run off with it, it's called a discovery. When he has a riot, it's called a Boston Tea Party. These Beckerwoods have a straight out riot in a harbor and tear up a damn ship, and they call it a tea party. Can you imagine? Call it a tea party.
That's right. makes no sense at all.
When they wipe out the Indians on TV, it's a victory. But if the Indians wipe them out, it's a massacre. I mean, this guy is forever playing word games. He's just the devil.
Yes,
sir. Yes, sir. As I said in the first Sunday action, I have to say it. I know it makes some of you uneasy, but I have to say it just every now and then. I have to say it. Because I believe you should remind yourself. Remind yourself to remember, to remember, to remember. Just so you won't forget that the white man is not a devil, but the white man is the devil. You wouldn't be here if some devil hadn't brought you here. Harlem wouldn't be run down if some devil hadn't put us in this condition. Brooklyn, none of it would be run down. Watts in Los Angeles, sections of Detroit, South Side, West Side of Chicago. It wouldn't be run down if some devil hadn't put us in this position. I know some of you love them. Lord have mercy, child. I just love everybody. I don't care what them old Farrakhan and Elijah Mohammed people say. I just love everybody. Lord have mercy, child. I just can't hate nobody.
That's what we say.
But you hate your black self. If you didn't hate your black self, you wouldn't wear a scary curl. You'd wear it the way God gave it to you. You'd wear a button saying, I'm nappy, and I'm happy. If you didn't hate yourself, you wouldn't wear it blonde. Blondes have more fun, and you ain't having no fun. What Spike Lee calls wannabe. Girl, you know you're a jigaboo, and we love jigaboos. Don't we love these jigaboos? Because this is God's woman. And when we say jigaboo, we mean you got that strong hat. Like our women got that good hat. Ain't that right? We got good hair, too. I got some. I had to spend some minutes this morning. I was just wearing bald. If I let it grow out, I got good hair, too. I need to stand up, too. Top of my head, just like yours. We say we love everybody, but we hate ourselves. Can you imagine a fellow moon walking across the stage and take scissors or something, cut his nose off and try to make his nose pointed like the white man? Have him to break his jaws and try to take the high pointed like the white man. Have him to break his jaws and try to take the high cheekbones out. Take shots and try to take the color out of his skin. Take some hormone shots and try to take the male out of his makeup. White folks just made them a product. Neither black nor white. Neither male nor female. Just for everybody. Whatever's your thing, I got it for you. I got a product for you. Should wear a stamp on his head saying, Made in America. And that's the way he was made. That's the way he was made. Made in America.
Died of malnutrition and starvation. Because they could tell by the rotting of the teeth and the jawline. So even though they most likely grew food, they weren't allowed to eat it. And then they found something even more peculiar that speaks to this idea of why he believed we required less sleep. They would show a large frame man, and they would find an injury where the muscle actually detached itself from the bone as a result of exertion and not injury. Stay with me. It detaches itself from the bone as a result of exertion. That means you work so hard, the muscle detached itself from the bone. You don't see those kind of injuries in contemporary society because no one's going to work that hard. Unless, of course, you have a gun trained on you from sunrise to sunset. So we do have empirical evidence of how hard folks worked. Then he went on to say that we were dumb, cowardly, and incapable of feeling grief. Why would Thomas Jefferson need to believe that? Why would he need to believe we didn't feel grief? What was he doing, do you think, that produced cognitive dissonance? You were killing people? Not only were you killing people, beating them, you were selling them, yes? Selling mothers away from their children and husbands away from wives. And surely they don't feel it. Because if they felt it, that would make them human like me. So I simply say, and you see, it's not even so much that he said it, but he was an important person. If Joe Nobody said it, but he said it. So what do you think the rest of the folks, uneducated laborers, believed? Well, they don't feel grief, you know. After all, Thomas Jefferson says they don't. So he becomes a critical person in making those statements. But you see, it was all to relieve and to settle the conscience that he died with. But these become very important as you see how these things move forward. Then there was J. Marion Sims. I won't spend a lot of time with him. He's another figure. You can Google him. There's a statue, actually, of him in Central Park. And J. Marion Sims was an individual credited. He was the father of modern gynecology. How many women in here know what a vaginal speculum is? And for those men in the room that we lost, a vaginal speculum is a device designed to open up the vagina. It was considered one of the most important advancements in medicine that was made. He was credited as being the wealthiest physician to have ever lived. And what's interesting about him, you know, look at the medals pinned on him. I was just very curious about how it was they regarded this man, because no one ever really looked at how did he come up with that vaginal speculum. The way he did it was he actually did experiments on unanesthetized slave women. He created a makeshift hospital in his backyard in the mid-1800s. He built the first vaginal speculum from a pewter spoon. And he reasoned that slave women were able to bear great pain, meaning we don't need any anesthesia, because their race made them more durable and thus they were well suited for painful medical experimentation. We didn't even, you know, because we didn't feel like other women could feel. This man would cut into them, and just said, well, since they're black, they don't really feel it. Unbelievable. And more importantly is what he did to infants, because not only did he experiment on women, he also experimented on infants. He said that black infants suffered from something he called trimus nascentium, which is now commonly referred to as neonatal tetanus. Neonatal tetanus originates in horse manure, which was the likely cause of the disease in slave infants. He attributed it to the indecency and intellectual flaws of slave infants, together with skull malformations at birth. That is a shoemaker's awl. And that's the 1800s shoemaker's awl. He would stick that into the heads of brand new infants in an effort to realign their skulls based on the indecency and intellectual flaws of their parents to treat the malady. Of course, it was 100% death rate. But that's what he would stick in the head of a baby at birth. And so these are things that are so horrific that you can't possibly wrap your head around it. And this man is, I mean, just Google him. And I think to myself, if I were up here in front of you right now, and this is going to become very important as I move into the other slides, if I stomped a puppy to death out here, up here, just a little puppy, and stomped it right here to death in front of you, most of you would need therapy. And I would be arrested probably faster than killing a black man for killing a puppy. How could you do that? Do you realize how much dissonance you have to remove in order to stick that into the brain of a child? More importantly, the child can no longer be human. Are you understanding what I'm saying? The reason why he could do it is they weren't human. They didn't even feel pain. That's what this man believed. Now, you may look at that and go, those are horrific things from the past. There is a book out right now, not table reading. It's called Medical Apartheid. This is written by Harriet Washington, came out last year. This book chronicles the experimentation on black people up to contemporary day. See, we want to look at the Tuskegee experiments. We want to look at Sims and go, oh, that just still going on. Implicated, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, because we weren't what? Human. So that dehumanization is something that we really got to appreciate went on for a long time. Can you go back? Back one more. No white could ever rape a slave woman. The regulations of law as to the white race on the subject of sexual intercourse do not and cannot, for obvious reasons, apply to slaves. Their intercourse is promiscuous. We've now justified raping black women because they can't be raped. We aren't raping them. They're promiscuous by nature. So we can't do it. Forward, one more. The fact that white men could profit from raping their female slaves does not mean that their motive was economic. The rape of slave women by their masters was primarily a weapon of terror that reinforced whites' domination over their human property. Rape was an act of physical violence designed to stifle black women's will to resist and to remind them of their servile status. These become important instruments that you look at. And I want to give you some statistics as it relates to American history. By the mid-1800s, there was over 600,000 mixed-race children born. 600,000. How many of you know what miscegenation is? Miscegenation is an illegal marriage between people of different races. Actually, was very profound here, that it was illegal to marry someone of another race. So when you consider the fact that one of the greatest issues and one of the number one reasons why black men were lynched, beaten, and imprisoned had to do with the fear that they were going to rape whom? White women. Now the numbers, I mean, we're talking about pure numbers, numbers alone. It was who being raped? Okay, it was black women being raped, but they can be raped. Let's advance forward. Before we get into the Casual Killing Act, the Casual Killing Act was written because of the number of people who were killed while being corrected. Okay, and if any slave resists his master, owner, or other person by his or her order, correcting such slave and shall happen to be killed in such correction, it shall not be counted felony, but the master, owner, and every other person so giving correction shall be acquitted of all punishment and accusation for the same as if such accident had never happened. So that means that if you happen to be correcting someone and you beat them to death, you know how hard it is to beat someone to death? I mean, I thought about that. I said it happened so frequently that they created a law so that you wouldn't feel any what? No guilt, because you were simply correcting them. It wasn't your fault. So I went back to look at who was beating folks to death. I wanted to know. And it was white women. White women were beating black children to death. That's who was being beaten to death. But it wasn't her fault. She was just correcting them. You see, what we do is we rob ourselves of our own humanity when we refuse to look at this stuff. We rob ourselves of our humanity. And that's what people didn't know happened. Going forward, one more. Then you had the mental health folks. This is how we got in. We got in to try to fix it. In the early years of the 19th century, a physician named Samuel A. Cartwright argued that two particular forms of mental illness caused by nerve disorders were prevalent among slaves. One was drapetomania, which was diagnosable by a single symptom, the uncontrollable urge to escape from slavery. So now what we've done is we've now pathologized your desire to be free. Must be something wrong with him. Keep trying to free himself. And again, it would be funny if it weren't in journals. You see, all of this is to remove the cognitive dissonance. Now we have, look at all the people joining in. You got Linnaeus, you got anthropology, you got physicians, all of them saying they deserve it. It's not us. We don't need to adjust anything. And if they just tried harder, how about you people just pull yourselves up from your bootstraps? What's the matter with you? The playing field has been leveled. Well, we're going to see if, in fact, it's been leveled. Or is that conjecture? Move forward. Now, I want you to look at this photo very closely, and I want you to see who's in it. More important than the man hanging, because you got to understand the lynchings that occurred in America happened after slavery, not during. Thousands of lynchings happened after slavery because this is a reaction to white fear of what we would do once freed. But we didn't create a vigilante group to take out white people, but they did create a vigilante group to take us out now that we're free. See, that happened after slavery. They were called the what? The Ku Klux Klan. They don't wear hoods anymore. They wear suits. But they're alive and well all over the world, even here. So look at who's in the picture. I want you to look at this little girl in particular. You can't see her closely, but she's actually grimacing, like smirking. Now, remember, let's go back to the puppy concept here. She would be loathed and torn up probably if this was a puppy, which means he's less than that, because she's not disturbed. This little girl is not disturbed by this.
We must understand clearly when we talk about capitalism, who are the capitalists? As if we understand that there are only a few people who own and control the means of production in the society, then we begin to understand that there are a few capitalists. And these capitalists exploit everybody because everybody works for them. Everybody sells their labor to them. It is by selling your labor to a capitalist that he's really able to exploit you. Instead of going through theories, let me give some direct example. Let's say that I'm a capitalist. And let's say that I sell shirts. I have a shirt factory. Let's say this is my factory. I own it. The machinery. I have a place where I get cotton. Now, I own it. I'm the capitalist. And let's say you are my workers. You are my workers. You don't know me. You never see me. You see my lackeys, you know, maybe my foreman, but you never see me. Now, let's say it costs me 50 cents for cotton for every shirt I make. And let's say it costs me 50 cents for upkeep of my machinery. That's a dollar. And let's suppose I pay you a dollar for every shirt you make. That means it costs me $2 to get a shirt, labor included, your labor. I pay you for making the shirt. Now, when I sell the shirt, being a capitalist, and you must know something about capitalism, very important. The sole motivating force in a capitalist society is profit. Profit. That is the sole motivating force. Profit. Get money. Get it. Get it as fast as you can. Get it any way you can, but get it. Just get it. Just get it. And even in the African community, it affects us here in this country because Africans, those of us living in America, those of us born in America, we are imbued with the philosophy of capitalism, and sometimes we don't even recognize it. Thus, you find brothers and sisters even selling dope to their brothers and sisters to make money. Again, because we're imbued with the philosophy of get some money. Ain't nothing wrong to kill for money. Hell, your country is napalming for money. You can certainly kill for some money. All right, just get it. Just get it. It's the overall philosophy. When we talk about revolution, we must talk about changing values. We must talk about changing values, and we must understand these values. To the shirt factory. I've not forgotten. I'm just going to tie it in. I'll tie it in for you. You will see, you must look under the shirt factory, too. You must look for spiraling economy. That's very important, spiraling economy. I sell the shirt for $5. I sell the shirt for $5. I don't do anything. You're the one who makes the shirt. I'm exploiting your labor. You toil, you sweat, I get the fruit. That's right, I get it. But you grow it, you plant it by the sweat of your brow. I get it. I sell the shirt for $5. I am exploiting your labor. I really am exploiting your labor. I mean, even when you want a shirt, hey, you got to come to my store and buy the shirt for $5. Hey, I really am exploiting you. Now, you're workers, you're in a factory, so you begin to get social consciousness. Yes, you do. Marx talks about this. Because you're working together, you see the socialized process, the laboring process, and you're able to see clearly how you're being exploited. So you get together, and you start talking about, we want more money. You tell my foreman we want more money. So the foreman comes to see me. He says, the workers say they want more money. Later for them. Keep them working, man. So he comes back, no raise. You all work, but you all get a little bit more agitated, you know, because it's scientific. The pressure rises, and as the pressure rises, the consciousness must rise. It's scientific. It can't be stopped. That's why revolution can't be stopped. Then you say, hey, look here. We're going to strike. So the foreman comes back and said, hey, they say they're going to strike. I say, oh, let them strike, man. And sure enough, you all strike. Yeah, y'all strike on me. Now, when you strike, of course, my machinery stops. I ain't making no money. So after a while, I call my foreman. I said, what do they want? He says, well, they said they want $1.50 more a shirt. They want 50 cents more a shirt. So I said, okay, let them have it. So I'll bring you back. You happy? I pay you $1.50 more. Right, so it now costs me $2.50 to make a shirt. It costs me $2.50 to make a shirt. Before, it cost me $2. I was selling it for $5. But hey, look here. I can't go out there and keep selling it for $5. Hey, how am I going to do that? I'm going to lose profit. And look here. Since the sole motivating force in a capitalist system is profit, ain't no need for me to come and sell it for $5.50. Hey, no. Next time you see that shirt on the market, it's going to cost you $7.50. Right. Right. And that's what's known as the spiraling economy, because profit is what about wages go up at the demands of the workers and prices rocket. Wages go up, prices rocket. And it keeps going and going and going until it's got to blow the top. It's scientifically real. That's why Nixon is talking about freezing wages and freezing prices. He's stupid. You got to freeze capitalism, Nixon. Freeze capitalism. That's the problem. That's the problem. You must understand these concepts, because once you begin to understand them and master them, you will see the inevitability of revolution. Not only the inevitability of revolution, but you will see the inevitability of victory for the struggling masses around the world once you understand the scientific principles of revolution.
In the 60s, you will see nothing but betrayals by the petty bourgeois elements in our society. The African bourgeoisie is the most corrupt bourgeoisie in the world. In Africa, they seek luxury in the midst of mass suffering. There are more Mercedes in Africa than in any other continent in the world. In America, as soon as they arrive at a position based on the blood of the people, they snatch that position and run away from the people. But you must not think that they represent the people. They only represent their opportunistic self using the people every step of the way. So you must not be confused. It must be clear then, for the 60s, the class struggle in the African Revolution must be more ruthless and uncompromising than in any other revolution. Here then, the masses must come without pity and without mercy to trample upon these reactionary pigs who, after the people have gained struggle through their blood, come to hand back the gains on a silver platter to the very enemy the people fought. This will come as a natural consequence. The people themselves are everywhere screaming that it's time for them to deal with these reactionary pigs. Even in America, they say, our leaders must be held accountable. They're only saying here that these people must be accountable to those who made it possible for them to get there. Thus, not only is the revolution inevitable, but it is clarifying itself and it is qualifying itself. For the African masses everywhere, the clairpoise position now for class struggle has become inevitable and irreversible. The petty bourgeoisie everywhere will be running for cover, but the masses will spare them not. Consequently, we who have dedicated our lives to the people's struggle, we who knowing that the people will always be free, we understanding that we must make a contribution to qualify our struggle since the 60s, have been dedicating all our energies to only one task, the organization of the masses of our people. The organization of the masses of our people. We are not running for mayor. we're not running for president. No changes can come from the top down. We're not stupid. Changes can only come from the bottom up. The masses and the masses alone can make them. If you want to learn something from the 60s, the lesson is simple. Organize the masses of the people. Thank you.
Such as they assured that the United States would come to its maturity under circumstances, which mean that for a substantial proportion of citizens, life is nothing more than a living debt. Liberty is nothing more than a prison of poverty. And the only happiness we enjoy is laughing to keep from crying. We find evidence for majority freedom and minority oppression in the fact that even while the early settlers were proclaiming their freedom, they were deliberately and systematically depriving Africans of their freedom. These basic contradictions were further aggravated by acts which implicitly admitted that the majority was wrong, but unwilling to do right. Thus, when the Declaration of Independence was drafted, the Founding Fathers struck all mentions of the slave trade. Thus, when the United States Constitution was drafted, the Founding Fathers considered the slaves as equivalent to three-fifths of a man. Thus, when the slaves were emancipated, the descendants of the Founding Fathers compromised that freedom to gain further territory. These compromises were so basic to the thinking of the forebears that legal attempts to correct the contradiction through constitutional amendments and civil rights laws have produced no change in our conditions, and we are still a people without equal protection and due process of the law. We recognize then that the oppressive acts of the United States government, when contrasted with the testaments of freedom, carries forward a basic contradiction found in all the legal documents upon which this government is based. Generation after generation of the majority group have been born, they have worked, and they have seen the fruits of their labor in the life, liberty, and happiness of their children and grandchildren. Generation after generation of black people in America have been born, they have worked, and they have seen the fruits of their labor in the life, liberty, and happiness of the children and grandchildren of the oppressor. While their own descendants wallow in the mire of poverty and deprivation, holding only to the hope of change in the future. The hope has sustained us for many years and has led us to suffer the administration of a corrupt government. At the dawn of the 20th century, this hope led us to formulate a civil rights movement and the belief that the government would eventually fulfill its promise to black people. We did not recognize, however, that any attempt to complete the promise of the 18th century revolution in the framework of a 20th century government, economy, and society was doomed to failure. The descendants of that small company of original settlers of this land are not among the common people of today. They have become a small ruling class in control of a worldwide economic system. The Constitution set up by their ancestors to serve the people no longer serves the people. For the people have changed. The people of the 18th century have become the ruling circle of the 20th century. And the people of the 20th century are the descendants of the slaves and the dispossessed of the 18th century. The Constitution set up to serve the people of the 18th century now serves the ruling circle of the 20th century. And the people of today stand wanting for a foundation for their own life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The civil rights movement has not produced this foundation, and it cannot produce this foundation because of the nature of the United States society and economy. The version of the civil rights movement, the vision of the civil rights movement is to achieve goals which have been altered by 200 years of change. Thus, the civil rights movement and similar movements have produced no foundation for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They have produced humiliating programs of welfare and unemployment compensation, programs with sufficient form to deceive the people, but with insufficient substance to change the fundamental distribution of power and resources in this country. Moreover, while the movements attempt to get minorities into the system, we note that the government continues this pattern of practice which contradicts its democratic rhetoric. We recognize now that we see history repeating itself, but on an international as well as a national scale. The relentless drive to profit led this nation to colonize, oppress, and exploit its minorities. This profit drive took this nation from democratic capitalism and underdevelopment to bureaucratic capitalism and overdevelopment. Now we see that this small ruler circle continues its profit drive by oppressing and exploiting the people of the world. Throughout the world, the proletariat is crushed so that the profits of the American industry can continue to flow. Throughout the world, the freedom struggle of oppressed people are opposed by this government because they are a threat to the bureaucratic capitalism of the United States of America. We gather here to let it be known at home and abroad that a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness has in its maturity become an imperialistic power dedicated to death, oppression, and the pursuit of profit. We will not be deceived by so many of our fellow men. We will not be blinded by small changes in form which lack any change in substance of the imperialist expansion. Our suffering has been too long. Our sacrifices have been too great. And our human dignity is too strong for us to be prudent any longer. The Black Panther Party calls for freedom and power to determine our destiny. The Black Panther Party calls for full employment for all our people. The Black Panther Party calls for an end to the capitalistic exploitation of our community. The Black Panther Party calls for decent housing for all people. The Black Panther Party calls for an educational system that will tell us the true facts about this decadent society. The Black Panther Party calls for exemption from the military service. The Black Panther Party calls for an end to police brutality. The Black Panther Party calls for freedom for all political prisoners and prisoners of war. The Black Panther Party calls for trials by members of our peer when we're brought to the court, and justice. The Black Panther Party calls for a United Nations plebiscite to determine the will of black people as to their national destiny. Black people and oppressed people in general have lost faith in leaders of America, in the government of America, and the very structure of the American government, that is the Constitution, its legal foundation. This loss of faith is based upon the overwhelming evidence that this government will not live according to the Constitution because the Constitution is not designed for its people. For this reason, we assemble a constitutional convention to consider rational and positive alternatives. Alternatives which will place the emphasis on the common man. Alternatives which will bring about a new economic system in which the rewards as well as the work will be equally shared by all people, a socialist framework. Alternatives which will guarantee that within the socialist framework, all groups will be adequately represented in decision-making and administration which affect their lives. Alternatives which will guarantee that all men will obtain their full manhood rights, that they will be able to live, be free, and seek out those goals which will give them respect and dignity while permitting the same privileges for every other man, regardless of his condition or status. The sacredness of man and of the human spirit requires that human dignity and integrity ought to always be respected by every other man. We will settle for nothing less, for at this point in history, anything less is but a living death. It is a fact that we will get change. We will transform the society. It is up to the oppressor to decide whether this will be a peaceful thing or we will use whatever means that is effective, regardless of the consequence, because it is our conclusion and our principle that a slave who dies a natural death will not balance two dead flags on the scales of eternity. We will have our manhood, even if we have to level the face of the earth. So I would like to say that we are one tonight. Let us be one in the future. Power to all of the people.
Here we are. Here we are. Here's for the people.
Egyptian mummies and a flag of a moon, and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youth, cause it's not like the future depends on it. But save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee them a make big money. This is how the media pillages on TV, the picture is savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a car, keep on, and all of a sudden you are there in Indiana Jones. And I see all the gold and see all the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzis I've ever seen and I've ever known. Put the words on this place that the world can see, and that's all I will ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like it'll be at home. Get tricked by the beast, but the way them are gonna flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them still can't defeat and them could have never clone. A spiritual DNA that prints in my soul and I will forever own, Lord.
It is always a relief to come home.
All right.
Now, that might sound like an odd thing to say, but home is where the spirit is.
All right.
And as I get older, I seem to be more and more preoccupied with the spirit that is Africa. Because I like to say that Africa is not just a geographical expression. Africa is not just a people. Africa is not just a state of mind, although it is all those things. Africa is our animating spirit, and is indeed the animating spirit of the world. Even the continents were born from Africa. Humanity, of course, itself was a child of Africa. What we call civilization is just one of Africa's latest products. And I think that our collective task is the rebuilding of that civilization. Because a civilization can never be the product or the image of one man or woman, no matter how blessed with genius they may be. Civilization can only be the result of the collective spirit of a people. In fact, 4 or 5 years ago, I even had someone said, you know, they knew that I was a physician, they knew that I had spent a lot of time reading and writing about African science. The empirical foundations of African scholarship, African intellect. And they noticed, they said, but Dr. Finch, you seem to be more and more preoccupied with spiritual matters than I ever knew you to be. And I says, well, yes, you are very perceptive, absolutely, because, you see, that is where it begins and ends for all of us. That indeed, to the extent that people of African descent have a major problem, it is indeed a spiritual problem. And until that spiritual problem is taken care of, anything else we do is futile. Now, one of the consequences, you might say, of my first, but by no means last, sojourn here among you in November was that we began to discuss, in some sense, the other dimensions that engulf of the universe. What we call modern physics only recognizes four dimensions: length, width, height, and time. But modern physics is now coming up against a brick wall of their own making, because they are finding that to get beyond those four dimensions, and by the way, those four dimensions are limited by the physical constant we know as light speed, but to get beyond them, there is only one way to go, and that is through consciousness, because the fifth dimension is consciousness or mind. And that with consciousness or mind, you encompass all the other four dimensions, and you transcend light speed. And it is therefore possible, really, as African adepts have known for time immemorial and have practiced for time immemorial, to in fact be two places at once. To indeed to see eternity in a second and the universe in a grain of sand through the medium of the mind, through the medium of the conscious, literally to go to the farthest ends of the universe. And there are those who do that, who encompass the universe, because if the universe is in fact mind, it is accessible to mind. And we find in ancient Kemet that what? The universe comes into being through the agency of the mind of the creator, who gives the creative word out of that mind, and his name is Jehudi or Thoth. The Dogon say that the universe is a thought in the mind of Amma, the creator. So we see that even in the profoundest of African philosophies, this idea that the universe is mind is at the very heart of their thinking. So modern physics is a latecomer to an essential truth that African adepts and sages have known from the beginning of humanity itself. And the word is there for anybody to see, read, hear, and understand. So in a sense, modern physics has been chasing its tail. It was always there, always at our fingertips. In the universe we know as the mind, or as Ivan Van Sertemeyer would say, as another way of looking at this issue, is that what happened 10 minutes ago or 10,000 years ago occupies the same space in this domain we call the mind. That means there are African adepts who can get to a place of timelessness, who can indeed move in more than one direction of time. And finally, physics has recognized that time moves in both directions. That time does not move in a single direction, which we call the arrow of time. So it is possible with these innate God-giving abilities that were honed to their highest refinement by the ancient adepts and the traditional adepts, some of whom are still existing today, to transcend time. To, as I like to say, predict the past and remember the future. Because modern physics is also coming finally to the ancient African idea that, in some sense, the future impacts the present, and the present impacts the past. What the past is determined by what is happening right now, actually. So time doesn't move in a single length like this. It moves in what? A circle. Because everything moves in circles. And again, All you have to do is read the thought and philosophy of ancient Kemet and the Dogon to understand this basic truism. These are the kinds of issues and questions that have been occupying my time and my attention. I have, as I have indicated to some, been adopted by two groups of traditional healers in Senegal. Slowly but surely, they are vetting me. You know what that means? That they are testing me. They don't just because they adopted me, they just don't give it up, you know. Just because I'm a nice fella, maybe. Just because I have a nice smile, maybe. I am watched, observed, and tested, not over hours, days, or weeks, but over years. And only at such time am I given a little tidbit, and then only just enough to find out the rest of it for myself, because the only true education is self-education. Your teachers and sages and spirit guides are not supposed to hand it to you and force-feed it to you like a child getting pablum or milk from a bottle. They are merely supposed to stimulate you so that you can go and find it for yourself, because then what you learn, what you acquire, descends from the brain consciousness to the heart consciousness. And when it is there, it is possible to transform yourself into a god. One of these, and this idea of God consciousness, of God presence that exists in all of us, the divine spark, again, is an ancient idea that is hoary with age in the African frame of things. So this is why, in order for me to embark on new levels of the path, I have to go to Africa to do that. At least I find that that's the way it happens for me. Just being on that soil, just being there, just soaking it up. And I don't ask questions. You will never hear me ask a question in Africa. That is not the way you get information. And that is, and it is Africa and Africa alone that I have learned what patience really means. Because with patience, time becomes not only your ally, time, work becomes your servant. You have to know how to wait. It is not a passive waiting. It is an expectant waiting, an active waiting, a positive patience, so that when the window of opportunity opens, you walk right through it and transform your life. Africa taught me that. So there is something that is ennobling, something that is transformational, just being on African soil, just absorbing those energies. My adopted mother, Mom Fatou Sek, 93 years old, a healer for 70 years, has performed 15,000 healings without one single failure. When I met her in 1986 in my own house, interestingly enough, not in Senegal, it was the first time I had ever felt the power of someone's aura. As I tell people, careful about coming into Mom Fatou Sek's presence, because there are no secrets from her. You do not even have to open your mouth. You can keep yourself as closed off as you think you are, and she can read you like a book. This is the power and presence of ancient Africa living through her. The problem is, she is 93. Her mind is as clear as crystal glass, is as limpid as a pristine pool, is as sharp as a diamond. But her body is frail. We are told that this may be her last calendar year on earth before she is called home. But what is her last will and testament? She has charged me as her adopted son with the responsibility of bringing her and all of her priestesses, drummers, ritualists, interpreters for a healing ceremony, 8-day healing ceremony on U.S. soil in St. Helena Island, in South Carolina, August 11th through 18th, 19th. We all know about African-derived religions here. Santeria, Candomblé, Vodou, Shango Baptist, even root doctoring. But this will be the first time in the entire history of the Americas that an authentic active, current, living African healing ceremony will be brought intact to the United States for the specific purpose of establishing the African spiritual presence here so that Africa's lost children will have direct access to the spiritual powers that will lead them into the new age. It is open to the public. We have a group of Native Americans who are coming to pay homage to Mom Sek to this, because they see the new age a coming. And this will be the first. This will be her fourth visit to the United States, and most likely her last. Open to the public, free of charge. The only thing required is yourself and your spirit. Not only for her, for yourself, but for those yet to come. Penn Center, St. Helena Island, South Carolina, August 11th through 19th. Please see Minister Clemson Brown for details. Please see Mr. Bill Jones, First World Alliance, for details. Yvonne Milliner for details. In African tradition, the most sacred of individuals are the newborn and the elderly. Why? Because they are closest to the ancestors and by definition are the wisest among us. We cannot make any headway without the guidance and the wisdom and the experience of our elders. We are here because they came before us. I first met Dr. John Henry Clark in 1982 in Raleigh, North Carolina. He defined the word erudition for me. You know what erudition means? It just means limitless knowledge. I don't think I had ever then or since met a man who knew so much. But I have met people who have accumulated facts and information. What set Professor John Henry Clark apart was the sharp, decisive, penetrating analysis, interpretations, explanations he gave for historical phenomena, unlike anybody I've ever known before or since. He is an institution. He is an icon. He is an elder. He is a living ancestor. His wisdom, his experience, his knowledge, his intellect is the fire that warms us. If he were in Africa, he would almost be worshipped, because the ancestors speak through him and he speaks for them to us. My mother, who is 81 years old, has always told her children, "Don't give me my flowers when I'm dead. There's nothing that I can do with it. You give me everything that is coming to me while I'm living." And this is what we do. Is that not true? We take our cultural heroes and we do not give them their proper due, the love that they have earned until they have passed on. It's all backwards. If we are going to engage, and you know, I'm going to give you these numbers, a 500-year process of reconstruction, because brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers, and children, sons and daughters, that's what it's going to take. And be ready for the task. Be ready to work for something that you will not see the fruit of until after your life has passed. And therefore, you can continue the work of John Henry Clark. You have a responsibility for continuing the work of John Henry Clark. You will be held accountable if you do not continue the work and build on the legacy of John Henry Clark. So, he is among us now. Let us touch him. Let us listen. Let us absorb. Let us be transformed by his sacred words. Professor John Henry Clark.
Dr. John Henry Clark. Okay. All right. All right. Dr. John Henry Clark. Let's give it up in a loud voice. We can do it. Dr. John Henry Clark. He could have been anywhere tonight, but he chose to be with us. Dr. John Henry Clark.
Looking menacingly at a white woman. Vagrancy, loitering, 10, 15 years for that. Here's the kicker. 25% of people under convict lease died. More than during slavery, because you don't kill off your property that you need to work for you. But they didn't have any protections because they have another label, do they not? And when you're going to oppress the subjugated people, what must you do? You must justify by relabeling them, but not only are they black, genetically inferior, lustful, careless, governed by caprice, but now they're criminals, which then justifies what we do. So 25% of them died under convict leasing. Well, look at how lucrative it was. Convict leasing was so successful that by 1898, nearly three-quarters of Alabama's total state revenue came directly from this institution. So then the trauma continued. But y'all free, right? Let's move on. So then we had, oh Lord, we got it now. Separate but equal. Is it equal now, friends? Still separate, though. You know where the Negroes are? Well, we're doing gentrification in Portland, but you know, we know where the black folks are, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
You know where to find them, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no, you know, sign on the freeway that says next left hood. But we know when we're there, don't we?
Keep it real.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Separate, never equal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's contemporary, right? Now we're going to get to the hot, where am I in time? You don't have a concept of that. Where are we? Where's the time person? Where am I in time?
You got 25
minutes. Excellent. So I wanted to endeavor to look at some of the more difficult pieces because I really wanted to take a look at some things that, I tell you, this moves into chapter 3. I need to talk about J. Marion Sims. Could you find his picture? J. Marion. Yes, he came earlier. He cleans up nice. J. Marion Sims, let me tell you a little bit about Jay. How many people, you know him, you know. There are huge statues and edifices for this man. Great thing. How many people in the room know what a vaginal speculum is? For those young men or men in the room that we've lost you there, what a vaginal speculum is? It's an instrument that was created to open up the vagina so folks could kind of peer in. Now, J. Marion Sims is the individual credited with that creation, and he is touted as being the wealthiest physician to have ever lived. J. Marion Sims was a physician in the mid-1800s, credited with the creation of the first vaginal speculum, which he made from a pewter spoon. Sims had built a makeshift hospital in his backyard where he conducted surgical experiments on unanesthetized African slave women. Sims reasoned that slave women were able to bear great pain because their race made them more durable and thus they were well suited for painful medical experimentation. So this is someone who took an oath to do no harm. And he cut into black women without any anesthesia. Now let me kind of get close with you around why this becomes very important. J. Marion Sims becomes very important because the first question I asked was, first of all, where do all the women come from? How do you get them? And what the problem was is it would be said that these women were not fit for duty by their slave masters. And here's why they weren't fit for duty. Many of the women suffered from what was called a fistula. An obstetric fistula is the breakdown of tissue in the vaginal wall, frequently as a result of childbirth, which affects the bladder and or the rectum. The disorder causes leakage of urine and feces into the vagina, which made for a smelly humiliating existence for the women. However, this condition did not preclude these slave women from participating in their daily work on the plantation, such as picking cotton, house cleaning, cooking, etc. So what duty were the women then unfit for? The obvious answer is that while black slave women were required to do manual labor alongside their black male counterparts, one of their other inescapable duties was to sexually serve their slave masters. Their malodorous condition made them less sexually desirable, and thus they were unfit for duty. So you need to clean them up, Mary and Sam, so we can do them. But what's more important about this is how we justify. Remember, in order to oppress or subjugate, you have to justify that behavior. But it wasn't only the women that suffered under his reign. Could you show the all, please? Slave women were not the only group to suffer. Black infants represent the most innocent of Sim's victims. Black infants suffered from what he termed trimus nascentium, now commonly referred to as neonatal tetanus. Tetanus originates in horse manure. The likely cause of the disease enslaved infants, given their living condition and their proximity to animal stables. Sims attributed the condition to the indecency and intellectual flaws of the black slaves, together with skull malformations at birth. Sims attempted to treat this malady by trying to pry the bones in the skulls of the tiny infants into alignment with a shoemaker's awl. I was careful to find one from the 1800s. He would stick that into the brain and the skulls of black infants at birth in an effort to realign their skulls because of the indecency of their parents. He is worshipped in this medical world, J. Mary Sims. But I was more curious about how a physician could do such a thing. And here's how you do it. You pathologize the people. Now, let me read what they said about black women, because it gets real specific, black women. Their first pathological symptom was their skin color. In a medical world that categorized life as either normal or pathological, people of the African diaspora were continually condemned to the category of pathological, their abnormal skin serving as a foil for normal white skin. Stay with me. The skin, if you see black people, the problem is the skin itself is pathological because it's actually a foil over normal white skin. This is what medical journals suggested. Now we're going to find out how they named it. Medical tradition has a long history of perceiving this skin color as a form of pathology. The favorite theory, which reappears with some frequency in the early 19th century, is that the skin color, an attendant physiognomy of the black, here's the reason why y'all black, is because of congenital leprosy. This is why there's so many of us. We all have congenital leprosy. Now, we have a second symptom. The second symptom of pathology was gender. Black females were perceived to be irreligious, lustful, and immoderate. Well, that's convenient, isn't it? Let's take a look at that. We need to really take a look at this one, because I have a whole chapter on rape. Can't even get close to what that did to me. There were over, and this comes out of a social work book. In a social work book, it states that there were over 600,000 mixed-race babies born in the mid-1800s, based on the census. Now, this was during miscegenation. That means it's illegal to marry. So who was sneaking out back, and who was raping whom? We have numbers. Young girls rarely made it to their teens before they were raped. But let's put that in perspective as a social science. Now, I want to get into that, to the fact that we were lustful, because then you see it's their fault, isn't it? Surely I raped them, but didn't they deserve it? Now we need evidence of how we know they're lustful and immoderate and immoral. Here we go. Their protruding buttocks and genitals were offered as physical evidence of their pathology. Anybody up there with a big butt? Anybody with a big butt out there? There you have it, you slut. It's incredulous, isn't it? It's hard for you to even believe it, but you see it's in books. And the criminally insane, right. But what was so amazing, I want to get right, let's get right up with that one, because the butt thing really threw me off. Because everybody wants that butt now, don't they?
Yeah.
J-Lo made it, gave us all permission to first have the butt. And it's an African butt, don't get confused about it. And it's a butt they couldn't keep their hands off of. Now they're injecting the butt now. They're putting butts in pants. They're making underwear with a butt in it. In addition to that, injecting the lymph with collagen, locking the hair, and telling you the whole time you're ugly. Still looking for the safest tan. Isn't that amazing? And the sad thing about it is we believe we're ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, 2006. Oh yeah, she was cute. She had good hair. Yeah, she had good hair. And he was fine. He was light skinned. Yeah. Look at the music video. Same girl, isn't it? We might as well just take him over and over again, tragic mulatto. Are you following me? I have people say to me, oh, Joy, are you going natural? Going natural? I mean, you even have blood to go, wow, she's militant. And that's because I actually wear my hair the way it grows out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody white in here, everybody goes, you're not going to keep it like that, are you? You're going to perm it or something, aren't you? Yeah, I just wear it like that, right? I can see your roots, girl. White people don't do that to white people. We have pathologized what is naturally us. And when we would want to assault or insult you, black, big lip, nappy hair, stay with me. You see, that's called post-traumatic slave syndrome. That's what that looks like. And then white people go, well, no wonder, look at them. They're so negative. Right? So let's move on. So then after all that, I want to take a look at another piece, because again, you know, when you think of someone that raped and did horrible things, you get the picture of a big gut toothless wonder. You know, and a straw hat and, you know, get the boys and go on out there and get them. Well, let's just move and start looking at the impact the strange fruit had. You all know a strange fruit. Billy got in trouble for reporting that one. But let's talk about the strange fruit. And this isn't in the book, by the way. I didn't put ugly pictures in the book. I'm not interested in re-injuring black people. But I want you to look at this picture, and there's only one reason why I want you to look at it, is I want you to look at who's in it. This was just plain old regular folk. And the way that little girl is looking at that man, she can't be right. That's what's wrong with white people, by the way. It's right there in that picture. Because, see, no one talks about what happened to white people. That's another book. But this is specifically, I show this picture because it's unbelievable. Got the little Sunday band. They ran train excursions and let children out of school early to attend lynchings. Lynchings. Now, let's show the other slide because I want to read this one. It's a rather gruesome one. I want to get you prepared. But I want to read from this one so you can understand what they did at the lynchings. If you want to know the reference to this, you can. I have a reading list in my book. In addition to that, you can go on site on my line online with my my website joyleary.com, and it'll give you some suggested reading. The name of the book that I would suggest are two. One is called 100 Years of Lynching. They're all newspaper accounts. That's by Ginsberg. 100 Years of Lynching. No pictures. This one is a famous picture that you will find in a variety of places, but one of them is called Without Sanctuary, recently published, which is a pictorial. And now what I'm doing is I'm going to read from the newspaper account. Before the torch was applied, the Negro was deprived of his ears, fingers, and genital parts of his body. He pleaded pitifully for his life while the mutilation was going on, but stood the ordeal of fire with surprising fortitude. Before the body was cool, it was cut to pieces, the bones were crushed into small bits, and even the tree upon which the wretch met his fate was torn up and disposed of as souvenirs. The Negro's heart was cut into several pieces, as was also his liver. Those unable to obtain the ghastly relics direct paid their more fortunate possessors extravagant sums for them. Small pieces of bone went for 25 cents, and a bit of the liver, crisply cooked, sold for 10 cents. As soon as the Negro was seen to be dead, there was a tremendous struggle among the crowd to secure the souvenirs. Knives were quickly produced, and soon the body was dismembered. Now I want you to look at who's in the picture. They're crowding to be in it, in suits. So whatever memory or thoughts we had about who these folks were, they were just plain common folk. But Joy, surely, you know, this has no relevance today. Between 1882 and 1967, 200 bills, and Senator Avil Gordley would know about this one, 200 bills were presented before Congress to outlaw lynching. Additionally, seven presidents urged Congress to end the practice. Each and every time these efforts were rejected by the Congress, and lynchings continued unabated and unpunished. It was not until 2005 that the U.S. Senate offered an apology for what it termed domestic terrorism against mostly black people. And even then, folks wouldn't sign on it. So did the trauma continue? Boy, we're an amazing people. We're an amazing people. But we don't know who we are. And you cannot heal what you don't understand. We can't heal it if we won't look at it. So how does it manifest itself? Very quickly, let me go through some of my research, because I'm going to give you some examples of it. There's a chart, and I did work specifically on African-American male youth violence. I didn't want to look at violence, by the way. What I really wanted to look at was something I term in the book vacant esteem, one of the symptoms of post-traumatic slave syndrome. Vacant esteem should not be somehow confused with low self-esteem. Low self-esteem is when you can't do as many chin-ups as maybe your sister or your brother. I'm not talking about that. And I don't think esteem should be measured in terms of low and high, because there are people with perfectly high self-esteem that are assholes. And you have to go to meetings with them. Don't you? But they have a high self-esteem. They ain't right, though. So I think esteem should be measured in terms of accurate esteem. Accurate esteem. Do you have an assessment of yourself that is appropriate? Not high or low, accurate and healthy. So these are things I looked at. I don't want to look at this. I told you, I don't want to look at violence. Why? Because my committee told me that vacant esteem wasn't a social problem. Clearly, that's not a social problem. A social problem, let me define it. Remember my graduate work. A social problem is a social problem, can be defined as a social problem if a significant number of people believe that it is a social problem, or significant persons believe it is a social problem. And we didn't qualify for either of those, not black people. But let me tell you why I wanted to look at self-esteem. I wanted to look at self-esteem because my first work was with children. I saw things happening with black children that bothered me and disturbed me. Aside from the good hair, bad hair, and all the other ugly, negative black epithets that we would throw at one another that I heard in contemporary world around me, I was concerned about what I saw happening to the hearts and minds of little black children. And one of the things that I started to notice happened directly after I had come from South Africa in 1994. I went to South Africa on the heels of the inauguration of Nelson Mandela. And it was a tough time in the country. And it was an incredible time for me, because it was in a fact for me, in a way, a rebirth, a pilgrimage, a point of normalcy that I never knew, because I never knew how to feel normal as a black person in America. This is an article recently published called, it says, "My Black Skin Makes My White Coat Vanish." This is a doctor who was standing in the lobby, and her clients would go, "Where's the doctor?" Right? We're invisible. And I grew up being invisible, discounted on a daily basis. So when I went to Africa, it was the first time in my life it felt normal being black. And so I cried a lot. I cried so much, in fact, the eight of the women that I was traveling with got a little through with me. Now, there's a reason why they got a little through with me. The reason they got a little through with me is because, see, in South Africa, in this southern region, actually I was in four countries, when you cry, you know, here they go, get that girl a tissue. Find a tissue, dry it up. In Africa, they sing. And they just start singing. Four-part harmony and breaking it off, right? And the whole room would just be singing until I stopped crying. And this was profound. The Queen of Lesotho had her royal choir come and sing to this group of 9 African-American women who were professionals traveling throughout the southern region. And this was really good and emotional, except there's a little catch. After they finished singing, they asked us to offer a few songs. And contrary to popular belief, we can't all sing. And so the women in my group were, you know, we did learn a few tunes, though. We were even on radio after a while. But my sister, who was traveling with me, we were on our way to Lesotho, actually, and they got up and they met without me, the women. And so when I woke up, my sister said, "Joy, you know we're going to Lesotho today." I said, "Yeah, I know." She goes, "And Joy, we're not singing in Lesotho." So whatever you need to do, Joy, to get your little stuff together, we need you to do that because we're not singing in Lesotho. So I said, I'm good. I got it. Holding it down. So we all go to Lesotho, and when they have this meeting, the meeting is actually larger than this room, and people are coming from all over. We got people coming from villages, people coming from the government, everybody is coming to greet these 9 African-American women. So we're sitting on the stage, and of course things have to be translated. So the guy who's translating, he is actually a descendant of slaves that were enslaved by the Dutch in a place called Umfravak in South Africa. And Umfravak means the unexpected in Afrikaans. They were left to die after apartheid ended. But this man had gone back to learn the tribal language, and so each one of us would get up and he'd translate. So I got up, I was the first one, all the women were looking at me glaring like,
right.
You gotta keep it together. So I got up there, I was good. I said, "My name is Joy DeGruyere, and I'm traveling with, you know, and we're trying to build a corridor relationship with our African sisters." And I sat on down, I thought I did good. My sister, like, thumbs up, everything's good. Translator gets up, starts translating. Then he starts going on and on and on and on and on. And people start chanting. It's just, you know, so my sister looking back at me. So I leaned over, I said, what'd you say? He goes, "I told him what you said." I said, "I didn't say all that." He said, "Oh, what had happened was," no, he said, "Well, when I got to the part where you said you were African-American, some of the people from remote villages got confused because they thought all Americans were white. So then I had to explain to them that you were the descendants of the ones that had been stolen away. And they were saying to you, 'Welcome home.'" So, you know, everybody was singing because I was crying. I was showing. My sister looks at me. So everybody's on their feet singing. I'm tore up, stuff, in the corner. So this black woman who was in the corner of the room walks all the way towards me, grabs me by the hand and said, "Did you think we would forget you? I am from Lesotho, and Lesotho is my home. If I leave Lesotho, Lesotho is still my home. If I leave Lesotho for 15 years, Lesotho is still my home. We mourned Malcolm and Martin with you. We are so, so very proud of you. You are African 300 years from home. We just wondered when you were coming back." Mm-hmm. And then I realized how much of me had been taken from me. So when I came home, I was a little depressed. To Portland, to the hood.
All right.
I was living on a knife, which is no longer the hood. But I was living on a knife, and folks were calling to see if I was coming out. They were worried. People on the trip called, "What's wrong with her? She ain't out." So finally, one day I had to come out because my daughter ran in. She goes, "Mom, there's a little boy outside. He said he going to beat up Nadim, that's her brother, and he going to pee on the car, too." Which, as you know, could happen in the hood. So I had to go outside. So I go outside to find a cruel young black boy standing. Ain't nobody over 10. My son's trying to hold his own, but he's scared. I walk right over to the little ringleader, and I said, "Has my son done something that I need to know about?" "Yeah, I want to know if he got some kind of eyeball problem." Not speaking bonics and that kind of women. "What did you say?" "I want to know if he got some kind of eyeball problem. What he's staring at." I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, you want to beat my son up because he was looking at you? Now, I want you to contrast that, because in Africa, when they talk to you, when they would, you know how, this is what black folks do, everyone. don't we do that?
Mm-hmm.
My white people ask you, God, you have so many friends. But that's an acknowledgement. We walk down the street in the grocery and try not to acknowledge somebody. What, you too good? don't do that, because it's so important in African culture. Or in Africa, it's even a step further. They, in all the languages, it translates to meaning, I see you. And isn't that what we're doing when we do this?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't have a language anymore, but we kept that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I'm looking at this boy telling me that he's going to beat my son into the ground because he was looking at him. I said, he could have been looking at you because he thought maybe you want to play a little basketball one-on-one. We got the hoop out here. He could have been looking at you because he could have maybe played a little video game. We got a little video game inside. He could have been looking at you because you know the park right down the street on 9th and Fremont. Maybe y'all could all go kick it. Right? So the little kids are looking at me like, whoa. And you know, I got a little therapeutic on them. So, finally, I give them my spiel about how we have to keep ourselves safe in the community and how we have to protect one another and stand together. And then I remembered Africa. And Africa said, I see you. And African said, what you looking at? What? What? Well, let me put that in perspective for you, because that happens, doesn't it? Let me put this in perspective as it relates to this. This comes out of the article I wrote. And, of course, you can find this article. It's very important. The Journal of Social Work Research and Practice. And you can go on my site and download it as well. So on African American Adolescent Respect, the scale that I wrote. But I want to read this particular excerpt from it so you can put in perspective in contemporary society what I mean about that, what you're looking at. According to Anderson, respect is an essential part of street rules that are strictly enforced and regulated. Simply maintaining eye contact for too long may be viewed as a lack of respect and an affront that can escalate into a confrontation. In a similar vein, a snide remark that might otherwise be viewed as trivial may lead to an honor contest. Boy, I wish I had more time to talk to you about that. Where no party backs down until someone is injured. This is taken from a book by Regine Persois. You can also find that in the book and on the website. This is a quote. On my way back from school, I saw a young brother on a crowded N train eating sunflower seeds. Between his legs laid a mound of wet, disgusting sunflower shells that he kept enlarging by spitting on the floor. Though visibly frustrated and disgusted by his behavior, no one would dare challenge his position. An older white man motioned to him to stop spitting the seeds on the floor. In response, he spat the seeds with much more animation than before, while effortlessly trying to stare fear into the old man. I made eye contact with him. And he said, what? What? Believe me, in the world of powerlessness, this is enough for a shootout. He leered at me, then said, I thought so. And I responded with my generation's favorite confrontation closer, whatever. Mm-hmm. Now we were both snaring, sneering, staring, flexing, profiling, and posturing at each other, refusing to yield the power we thought we had, creating two more powerless brothers in a confrontation over bullshit, two intellectual amputees looking for the upper hand while mentally handcuffed. That's today. That goes on. So I wanted to understand, what is the relationship with that contemporary behavior? And why did that little boy look at my son and feel so threatened by him looking at him? What must he have thought my son was seeing? Because based on what we know about Erickson's model of development, what we know about Piaget, what we understand about human development, is that I attain to my self-concept based upon the appraisal of significant others in my life. So I am not who I think I am, and I am not who you think I am. I am who I think that you think that I am. So what did he think my son believed about him? What did he see peering back at him? He saw peering back what he hated in himself, and he was 10 years old. And I said, what has happened to this little boy that he cannot withstand the gaze, that he so hates the reflection in the mirror that he would destroy my son to destroy the image? That is post-traumatic slave syndrome. That's why I endeavored to look, and I didn't want to look at violence. I wanted to look at the internalized violence, but that wasn't a social problem. So then I looked at young men that hurt each other. So first, on the left-hand side, you have stress variables. The first two variables are what we call baseline variables, violence witnessing and violence victimization. On the right-hand side, you have the dependent variable. In other words, I'm trying to predict this, and that is use of violence. I'm trying to see what the other variables have to do with the use of violence. So now those two baseline variables we already know produce violence. When people witness violence or experience being hurt, they are more likely to be violent. Fundamental basis baseline. The variable at the end is called daily urban habits. Now, this is written by a black man, this scale. Sometimes, how many people have heard of a stress inventory? Basically, they say if you move, you get some points. You get divorced, the dog dies. Anything, you get points. And we should have black on there, huh? Because being black creates a stressor, does it not? Now, I want you to know, being black and living in this skin, we've normalized the stress. Haven't we? It happens so often, and they wonder why you act up when you get to the office. Because by the time you get to the office, you will have been assaulted so many times before you got there. You know, the person that somehow you're standing in front of them, but you're invisible to. By the time you get to work, the person that's sitting right next to you that doesn't say hello to you. You know, because that happens every time. You're invisible at work. We all black people are invisible in white environments for a number of reasons. I don't have time to talk about that. But one of them is, in African culture, this is what we always do. And you know what? If I see you this morning, I see you later on, I'll do that again. Mm-hmm. Because it's something we do. And you have people where greeting is perfunctory, so they'll look at you and keep going. Standing right next to you. Or they'll go, excuse me, can you get me those papers? What black people going to say? Hello? Good morning? Good afternoon? Right? Oh, well, hi. Could you get me those papers? Right? Because we have a very different experience living here in America. But one of the things that I understand is not respecting a person and the idea of the stressors associated with being black, putting electrodes on a black man when a police car drives up behind him. Let's measure that stress. I have to name these because I'm not going to have time to talk about them. You must get, after you get mine. One is called Breaking Rank. Norm Stamper. 34-year police veteran, chief of police for Seattle, retired, chief of police for San Diego, retired. Wrote a book called Breaking Rank, has a chapter entitled Why White Cops Kill Black Men. Whole chapter. He told on everybody. And when he broke rank, he took folks down. He took them down. I don't know what happened to this man, but he started telling the truth. There is a slide you have to show. And that is the one where it says, oh, you got it up there. Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't see it. He said, I've heard some police officers refer to prostitute slayings or to the slayings of blacks as misdemeanor murders, employing an unofficial code for this, NHI, no human involved. San Diego cops confessed to a myriad other acts of discriminating, including additional dehumanizing references to blacks on a radio call just at 11:13 nigger, 11:13 being a code for an injured animal, followed by, a descriptor dog, cat, skunk. It was a pernicious form of discriminating injected with a large dose of misogyny that led to the labeling of the lone female officer in my academy class as a split tail, speculated as something to do with a woman's vagina. This man goes on to give statistics on how many police officers in every police department across the United States are predators, and saying that if you have a mother, a sister, a wife, a daughter, you should be afraid for them. Because they become police officers to prey on women. He told. Now, I got to tell you, the man lives in a cabin on a mountain somewhere in the San Juan. So he knew it was going to happen. This is a situation where, again, I'm not going to have time to cover that, but let me move on and move back to the violence scale. Very good book, very important. I think black folks should keep it on the dash of the car. Because they may say we're paranoid, but folks are following us according to the data there. Another book you need to read, All God's Children. Fox Butterfield wrote the book. Fox Butterfield talked about violence, and here you find out who pushed whom first. Perfect representation, post-traumatic slave syndrome, if you want to see it, in the life of a gentleman that actually was the reason why we started trying youth as adults. his this particular situation here. Let me read this one, because I think this is an amazing one. The last one I read. According to Butterfield, what emerged was not just a portrait of the Bosket, the gentleman Willie Bosket, the one who's now serving consecutive life terms. Youth tried as adult because of Willie Bosket. But a new account of the origin and growth of violence in the United States. Violence is not, as many people today presume, a recent problem or a peculiarly urban bane. Rather, it grew out of a proud culture that flourished in the antebellum rural South, a tradition shaped by whites long before it was adopted and recast by some blacks in reaction to their plight. The records also show that the vast majority of people put on trial for violent crimes in antebellum South Carolina were whites, the slaves were believed to be or thought to be a gentle people. Butterfield describes two forms of violence among the lower and upper classes, knockdown, drag out, where individuals often had their nose, eyes, or ears ripped from their bodies, and dueling, shooting and killing as a means for gentlemen to settle disputes. Now, I want to put this in perspective in terms of my research that looked at respect. Are you following me? What was modeled is honor and manhood. How does a 16-year-old black male in America get respect? Remember who modeled it. A duel is just a dressed-up drive-by. But what I understand about that how are you a man as a black man in America? If you don't have the material means to assert dominance or control over your resources, you have learned helplessness. Research tells us that too. Or you have hyper-masculinity, where I've got to assert my manhood somewhere and somehow. So I'll strike fear in you. Survival. Adaptation. How do you learn to survive and adapt in a hostile environment? That's what black people have done all this time. And sometimes we heal crooked. Sometimes we did. But let me tell you this one thing. I don't know. Where am I in time? Okay. Let me just move, and I'll give you time to give me questions. But I want to give you put the slide up in terms of adaptation. What I did discover in my research, by the way, is that all my hypotheses are correct. The more urban hassles, more violence, more victimization, more violence, more witnessing, more violence. Racial socialization, middle variable, written by Stevenson, Howard Stevenson, out of Penn State, black man. He said, this is a resiliency factor, so pay attention to this. He suggested racial socialization as an important way of measuring how black people cope and adapt. Well, what is racial socialization? You help black children, black men, women, know that you're walking out on a racially charged battlefield, but you give them armor. I'm going to tell you, you don't have to be worried. You don't have to trust what my high school counselor told me, which was that I wasn't college material. Don't trust that. But you know what? We got your back. You got a God. You got mama, daddy, big mama, big daddy. We here for you. And guess what? You're not a descendant of slaves after all. You're a descendant of captured free men and women. And you know what? It's going to be all right, because joy comes in the morning. And we found out that the way you socialize a black child, you have less violence. I look right here at Portland. 200 African-American males, 100 incarcerated, 100 were not. Some of them were in the Rites of Passage program. People know Kevin Fuller. Yeah, I used that as a control group, and I used 100 of them that were incarcerated, and found out that those who were racially socialized were less likely to be violent. But more important was what I discovered about respect. And what I discovered about respect is that when you disrespect black males, and what do they do in prison? They try to break them. You're going to create a prisoner. Now, you're going to create a criminal. You're going to create a sociopath. Because if you disrespect him, you're going to have more violence. And guess what? I put all the variables, multiple regression, stepwise, regression analysis. So I wanted to look at all the variables and how they behaved and performed. Highest, greatest predictors of violence. What were the most significant predictors of violence among African-American male youth? All 200 of them. After victimization and witnessing fell out, respect. Now, more importantly, what does respect mean? What does respect mean to a black male? I ask people, what does respect mean? I ask white men. White men told me it means earned regard. When I ask black men, they said it's a sense of worth and value. Much deeper, isn't it? Guess what respect means? Doesn't mean either of those, by the way. Comes from the Latin. Respect. Look again. That's what respect means. Look at me again. Don't look the first time. Look again. That's what it means to respect. And that's all these young men were saying, please look at me again. And I want you to put that in context. I see you. Look again. That's what my research taught me, that these young men wanted you to look at them again. But we can't look past our socialization in America. So we need to socialize them. These are the destructive behaviors. Let's look at the corrective behaviors. I'll just put it up there and we'll talk about them. Because we did have, not pathology, we have resiliency built up. These are the things we've used through the years, and I've broken them down from Ma'afa all the way to current status, the things. And I want to note for you that during Katrina, after we all know little was done, they employed the very same methods to wrap you in so that you would go to sleep, to subjugate and oppress. What do you have to do to subjugate or oppress any group of people? You must justify the behavior by what? Relabeling them, and after all, they're just looters and rapists.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they wrap you in that and go black?
Mm-hmm.
More died after that. I've been in the Ninth Ward. My family's from Louisiana. But they don't even tell you the number that died after Katrina. They don't even tell you about it because they've already convinced you they're bad people, even here in Portland. In Dallas, everywhere. We've relabeled them so everybody can wrap themselves in that. So we do have positive behaviors. We do understand once we look at some of these behaviors around how we look at each other, how our attitudes, we can, in fact, turn them around, but you can't change what you don't know. The book is full of those. I certainly didn't have enough time in this day to share it. I don't do justice to what the book does because it does go in great depth. Chapter 6, which is a chapter on healing, the reason I wrote the book, note the title, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. We can heal. Imagine we've come this far with no help. Imagine how much more we can do if we understand it and we can start changing it. Thank you very much.
I'm sure the rest of the audience did also. I'm just kind of bowled over. That really, really impacted me. And I don't really know where to start. So what I would like, we don't have any time. We were supposed to end at 1:30, but I just was not going to interrupt her. And if people have any questions, this is the time, or you can wait till it's over. Thank you.
In comparison, when you talk about Katrina, first thing that I when I heard about Katrina, the first thing I thought about was Vanport.
Of course.
It's one of the same.
No question.
So.
And Vanport flood, the displacement, all the things were the same, and also the disparity with what black people who experienced, not just black people, but poor whites as well. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, they used to do I don't know if they do it now for incoming professors here at Portland State, they used to show a video of the making, because this was called Vanport College. And mm-hmm. the first time I saw it, not only was there not a black person in it, there were no women in the whole video, and they thought that was okay. So I complained a lot and brought pictures and gave it to them. So anyone that's seen it, I don't know if they've added black folks in there, but when I first got, came into the program, there were no black people apparently. But there were poor blacks and whites in Vanport, that place called Vanport, and the flood killed far more than what the newspaper account said, based on the accounts of the people themselves, right? So you still had that, and then you had, again, further displacement, and again displaced again. So these are things that are, again, right up in front of us. It happens, and we are silent, which is the reason why it continues that.
Can I just make an announcement?
Sure.
On November 21st, Joanne Bowman from Oregon Action is going to be here to be our next speaker for the Black Bag. And Avel Gordley, I think she's left. Hi, Avel. Avel is going to host that event. I won't be here. And so I hope all of you can be in attendance for that event also. Thank you.
Now, I know, Randy, I got a book for you. I told you I'd give you a book. I'm giving you a book, so I'm going to give you a book.
Do you have any here?
I brought one little box of books. So if anybody wants a book, I have.
I want one with your signature.
Okay, well, why don't I do that right now? Okay, I'm going to do that because I know they're going to close us down. You can always come up and ask. You want to have a question or something?
No, for a book.
And you can't leave, but you know where my car is. But I saw the sister. Yeah, I've
been away from Portland for a long time. And when I come back, there's two things that strike me as a black woman.